was on the other side of the fence. He had the reputation of a fiercely committed anti-smoking activist. A gorilla, some called him. In a prior life, he had been employed at the Tobacco Focus Council, which was nothing more than a slick lobbying outfit funded entirely by the industry, he said with disdain. Our mission was to advise the tobacco companies on current legislation and attempts to regulate them. We had a fat budget with unlimited resources to wine and dine influential politicians. We played hardball and we taught other tobacco apologists the ins and outs of political fistfighting. At the council, Robilio had access to countless studies of cigarettes and the tobacco industry. In fact, part of the mission of the council was the meticulous assimilation of all known studies, projects, experiments. Yes, Robilio had seen the infamous nicotine memo Krigler had described. He'd seen it many times, though he did not keep a copy. It was well known at the council that all tobacco companies kept nicotine at high levels to ensure addiction. Addiction was a word Robilio used over and over. He'd seen studies paid for by the companies in which all sorts of animals had been quickly addicted to cigarettes through nicotine. He'd seen and helped hide studies proving beyond any doubt that once young teenagers were hooked on cigarettes, the rates of kicking the habit were much lower. They became customers for life. Rohr produced a box of thick reports for Robilio to identify. The studies were admitted into evidence, as if the jurors would find the time to plow through 10,000 pages of documents before making their decision. Robilio regretted many things he'd done as a lobbyist, but his greatest sin, one he struggled with daily, had been the artfully worded denials he'd issued, claiming the industry did not target teenagers through advertising. Nicotine is addictive. Addiction means profits. The survival of tobacco depends upon each new generation picking up the habit. Kids receive mixed messages through advertising. The industry spends billions portraying cigarettes as cool and glamorous, even harmless. Kids get hooked easier and stay hooked longer. So it's imperative to seduce the young. Robilio managed to convey bitterness through his man-made voice box. And he managed to sneer at the defense table while looking warmly at the jurors. We spent millions studying kids. We knew that they could name the three most heavily advertised brands of cigarettes. We knew that almost 90% of the kids under 18 who smoked preferred the top three advertised brands. So what did the companies do? They increased the advertising. Did you know how much money the tobacco companies were making off cigarette sales to children? Rohr asked, certain of the answer. About $200 million a year, and that's in sales to kids 18 or under. Of course, we knew. We studied it annually, kept our computers filled with the data. We knew everything. He paused and waved his right hand at the defense table, sneering as if it were surrounded by lepers. They still know. They know that 3,000 kids start smoking every day, and they can give you an accurate breakdown of the brands they're buying. They know that virtually all adult smokers began as teenagers. Again, they have to hook the next generation. They know that one-third of the 3,000 kids who start smoking today will eventually die from their addiction. The jury was captivated with Robilio. Rohr flipped pages for a second so the drama wouldn't be rushed. He took a few steps back and forth behind the lectern as if his legs needed limbering. He scratched his chin, looked at the ceiling, then asked, When you were with the Tobacco Focus Council, how did you counter the arguments that nicotine is addictive? The tobacco companies have a party line. I helped formulate it. It goes something like this. Smokers choose the habit, so it's a matter of choice. Cigarettes are not addictive, but hey, even if they are, no one forces anybody to smoke. It's all a matter of choice. I could make this sound real good back in those days, and they make it sound good today. Trouble is, it's not true.
Why isn't it true?
Because the issue is addiction, and the addict cannot make choices, and kids become addicted much quicker than adults.
Rohr for once avoided the natural lawyerly compulsion of overkill. Robilia was efficient with words, and the strain of being clear and being heard tired him after an hour and a half. Rohr tendered him to Cable for cross-examination, and Judge Harkin, who needed coffee, called a recess. Hoppy Dupree made his first visit to the trial Monday morning, slipping into the courtroom midway through Robilio's testimony. Millie caught his eye during a lull and was thrilled he would stop by. His sudden interest in the trial was odd, though. He'd talked of nothing else for 4 hours last night. After a 20-minute coffee break, Cable stepped to the lectern and tore into Robilio. His tone was strident, almost mean, as if he viewed the witness as a traitor to the cause, a turncoat. Cable scored immediately with the revelation that Robilio was being paid to testify and that he had sought out the plaintiff's lawyers. He was also on retainer in 2 other tobacco cases.
"Yes, I'm being paid to be here, Mr. Cable, same as you," Robilio said, delivering the typical expert's response. But the stain of money slightly tainted his character.
Cable got him to confess that he started smoking when he was almost 25, married with 2 children, hardly a teenager who could have been seduced by slick work from Madison Avenue. Robilio had a temper, a fact proven to all the lawyers during a 2-day marathon deposition 5 months earlier, and Cable was determined to exploit it. His questions were sharp, rapid, and designed to provoke.
"How many children do you have?" Cable asked.
3.
Did any of them ever smoke cigarettes regularly?
Yes.
How many?
3.
How old were they when they started?
It varies.
On the average?
Late teens.
Which ads do you blame for getting them hooked on cigarettes?
I don't recall exactly.
You can't tell the jury which ads were responsible for getting your own kids hooked on cigarettes?
There were so many ads, still are. It would be impossible to pinpoint 1 or 2 or 5 that worked.
So it was the ads.
I'm sure the ads were effective, still are.
So it was somebody else's fault.
I didn't encourage their smoking.
Are you sure? You're telling this jury that your own children, the children of a man whose job for 20 years was to encourage the world to smoke, began smoking because of slick advertising?
I'm sure the ads helped. They were designed to.
Did you smoke in the home in front of your children?
Yes.
Did your wife?
Yes.
Did you ever tell a guest he couldn't smoke in your home?
No, not then.
Safe to say, then, that the environment of your home was smoker-friendly.
Yes, then.
But your children started smoking because of devious advertising? Is that what you're telling this jury?
Robilio took a deep breath, counted slowly to 5, then said,
I wish I'd done a lot of things differently, Mr. Cable. I wish I'd never picked up the first cigarette.
Did your children stop smoking?
2 of them did, with great difficulty. The 3rd has been trying to quit for 10 years now.
Cable had asked the last question on an impulse and wished for a second he hadn't. Time to move on. He shifted gears.
Mr. Robilio, are you aware of efforts by the tobacco industry to curb teenage smoking?
Robilio chuckled, which sounded like a gargle when amplified through his little mic.
No serious efforts, he said.
$40 million last year to smoke-free kids?
Sounds like something they'd do. Makes them seem warm and fuzzy, doesn't it?
Are you aware that the industry is on record supporting legislation to restrict vending machines in areas where kids congregate?
I think I've heard of that. Sounds lovely, doesn't it?
Are you aware that the industry last year gave $10 million to California for a statewide kindergarten program designed to warn youngsters about underage smoking?
No. What about overage smoking? Did they tell the little fellas that it was okay to smoke after their 18th birthdays?
probably did.
Cable had a checklist and seemed content to fire off the questions while ignoring the answers.
Are you aware that the industry supports a bill in Texas to ban smoking in all fast food establishments, places frequented by teenagers?
Yeah, and do you know why they do things like that? I'll tell you why. So they can hire people like you to tell jurors like these about it. That's the only reason it sounds good in court.
Are you aware that the industry is on record supporting legislation which imposes criminal penalties against convenience stores which sell tobacco products to minors?
Yeah, I think I heard that one, too. It's window dressing. They'll drop a few bucks here and there to preen and posture and buy respectability. They'll do this because they know the truth, and the truth is that $2 billion a year in advertising will guarantee addiction by the next generation. And you're a fool if you don't believe this.
Judge Harkin leaned forward.
Mr. Robilio, that is uncalled for. Don't do it again. I want it stricken from the record.
Sorry, Your Honor, and sorry to you, Mr. Cable. You're just doing your job. It's your client I can't stand.
Cable was thrown off track. He offered up a lame why and wished immediately he'd kept his mouth shut.
Because they're so devious. These tobacco people are bright, intelligent, educated, ruthless, and they'll look you in the face and tell you with all sincerity that cigarettes are not addictive, and they know it's a lie.
No further questions, Cable said halfway to his table.
Gardner was a town of 18,000 an hour from Lubbock. Pamela Blanchard lived in the old section of town, two blocks off Main Street, in a house built at the turn of the century and nicely renovated. Brilliant red and gold maple trees covered the front lawn. Children roamed the street on bikes and skateboards. By 10 Monday, Fitch knew the following. She was married to the president of a local bank, a man who'd been married once before and whose wife had died 10 years ago. He was not the father of Nicholas Easter or Jeff or whoever the hell he was. The bank had almost collapsed during the oil bust of the early 80s, and many locals were still afraid to use it. Pamela's husband was a native of the town. She was not. She may have come from Lubbock, or maybe it was Amarillo. They got married in Mexico 8 years ago, and the local weekly barely recorded it. No wedding picture, just an announcement next to the obituaries that N. Forrest Blanchard, Jr. had married Pamela Kerr. After a brief honeymoon in Cozumel, they would reside in Gardner. The best source in town was a private investigator named Rafe, who'd been a cop for 20 years and claimed to know everyone. Rafe, after being paid a sizable retainer in cash, worked without sleep Sunday night. No sleep, but plenty of bourbon, and by dawn he reeked of sour mash. Dante and Joe Boy worked beside him in his grungy office on Main and repeatedly declined the whiskey. Rafe talked to every cop in Gardner and finally found one who could talk to a lady who lived across the street from the Blanchards. Bingo. Pamela had 2 sons by a previous marriage. It ended in divorce. She didn't talk much about them, but one was in Alaska and one was a lawyer, or was studying to be a lawyer, something like that. Since neither son grew up in Gardner, the trail soon ran cold. No one knew them. In fact, Rafe couldn't find anyone who'd ever seen Pamela's sons. Then Rafe called his lawyer, a sleazy divorce specialist who routinely used Rafe's primitive surveillance services, and the lawyer knew a secretary at Mr. Blanchard's bank. The secretary talked to Mr. Blanchard's personal secretary, and it was discovered that Pamela was from neither Lubbock nor Amarillo, but Austin. She'd worked there for a bankers' association, and that's how she'd met Mr. Blanchard. The secretary knew of the prior marriage and was of the opinion that it had ended many years ago. No, she had never seen Pamela's sons. Mr. Blanchard never discussed them. The couple lived quietly and almost never entertained. Fitch received reports every hour from Dante and Joe Boy. Late Monday morning, he called an acquaintance in Austin, a man he'd worked with 6 years earlier in a tobacco trial in Marshall, Texas. It was an emergency, Fitch explained. Within minutes, 12 investigators were scouring phone books and making calls. It wasn't long before the bloodhounds picked up the trail. Pamela Kerr had been an executive secretary for the Texas Bankers Association in Austin. One phone call led to another, and a former co-worker was located working as a private school guidance counselor. Using the ruse that Pamela was a prospective juror in a capital murder case in Lubbock, the investigator described himself as an assistant district attorney who was trying to gather legitimate information about the jurors. The co-worker felt obligated to answer a few questions, though she hadn't seen or talked to Pamela in years. Pamela had two sons, Jeff and Alex. Alex was 2 years older than Jeff and had graduated from high school in Austin, then drifted to Oregon. Jeff had also finished high school in Austin, with honors, then gone to college at Rice. The boy's father had abandoned the family when they were toddlers, and Pamela had done an outstanding job as a single mother. Dante, fresh off the private jet, accompanied an investigator to the high school, where they were allowed to rummage through old yearbooks in the library. Jeff Kerr's 1985 senior picture was in color. A blue tux, large blue bow tie, short hair, earnest face looking directly at the camera, the same face Dante had studied for hours in Biloxi. Without hesitation, he said, "This is our man," then quietly ripped the page from the yearbook. He immediately called Fitch on a cell phone from between the stacked tiers of books. Three phone calls to Rice revealed that Jeff Kerr graduated there in 1989 with a degree in psychology. Posing as a representative from a prospective employer, the caller found a Rice professor of political science who taught and who remembered Kerr. He said the young man went to law school at Kansas. With the guarantee of serious cash, Fitch found by phone a security firm willing to drop everything and began scouring Lawrence, Kansas for any trace of Jeff Kerr. For one normally so chipper, Nicholas was quite reserved during lunch. He didn't say a word as he ate a heavily stuffed baked potato from O'Reilly's. He avoided glances and looked downright sad. The mood was shared. Leon Robilio's voice stayed with them, a robotic voice substituted for a real one lost to the ravages of tobacco, a robotic voice which delivered the sickening dirt he once helped hide. It still rang in their ears. 3,000 kids a day, one-third of whom die from their addiction. Gotta hook the next generation. Lorene Duke tired of picking at her chicken salad. She looked across the table at Jerry Fernandez and said, "Can I ask you something?" Her voice broke a weary silence. "Sure," he said. "How old were you when you started smoking?"
14.
Why did you start?
The Marlboro Man. Every kid I hung around with smoked Marlboros. We were country kids, liked horses and rodeos. The Marlboro Man was too cool to resist.
At that moment, every juror could see the billboards, the rugged face, the chin, the hat, the horse, the worn leather, maybe the mountains and some snow, the independence of lighting up a Marlboro while the world left him alone. Why wouldn't a young boy of 14 want to be the Marlboro Man?
"Are you addicted?" asked Ricky Coleman, playing with her usual fat-free plate of lettuce and boiled turkey. The "addicted" rolled off her tongue as if they were discussing heroin. Jerry thought for a moment and realized his friends were listening. They wanted to know what powerful urges kept a person hooked.
"I don't know," he said. "I guess I could quit. I've tried a few times. Sure would be nice to stop. Such a nasty habit."
"You don't enjoy it?" Ricky asked.
"Oh, there are times when a cigarette hits the spot, but I'm doing 2 packs a day now, and that's too much."
"What about you, Angel?"
Lorene asked Angel Wheeze, who sat next to her and generally said as little as possible.
"How old were you when you started?"
13,
Angel said, ashamed.
"I was 16. Sylvia Taylor Tatum admitted before anyone could ask.
"I started when I was 14,
Herman offered from the end in an effort at conversation.
"Quit when I was 40.
"Anybody else?"
Ricky asked, finishing the confessional.
"I started at 17, the colonel said, when I joined the army, but I kicked the habit 30 years ago.
As usual, he was proud of his self-discipline.
"Anybody else?"
Ricky asked again after a long, silent pause.
"Me?"
I started when I was 17 and quit 2 years later, Nicholas said, though it was not true.
Did anybody here start smoking after the age of 18? Lorene asked.
Not a word.
Nitschman, in plain clothes, met Hoppy for a quick sandwich. Hoppy was nervous about being seen in public with an FBI agent and was quite relieved when Nitschman appeared in jeans and a plaid shirt. Wasn't like Hoppy's pals and acquaintances around town could instantly spot the local feds, but he was still nervous nevertheless. Besides, Nitschman and Napier were from a special unit in Atlanta, they'd told Hoppy. He replayed what he'd heard in court that morning, said the voiceless Robilio made quite an impression and seemed to have the jury in his pocket. Nitschman, not for the first time, professed little interest in the trial and explained again he was just doing what his bosses in Washington told him to do. He handed Hoppy a folded sheet of paper, plain white, with tiny numbers and words scattered on the top and bottom, and said this had just come from Cristano at Justice. They wanted Hoppy to see it. It was really a creation of Fitch's document people, two retired CIA boys who puttered around D.C. enjoying the mischief. It was a faxed copy of a sinister-looking report on Leon Robilio. No source, no date, just four paragraphs under the ominous headline of Confidential Memo. Hoppy read it quickly while chomping on French fries. Robilio was being paid $500,000 to testify. Robilio had been fired from the Tobacco Focus Council for embezzling funds, had even been indicted, though charges were later dropped. Robilio had a history of psychiatric problems. Robilio had sexually harassed two secretaries at the council. Robilio's throat cancer had probably been caused by his alcoholism and not by tobacco. Robilio was a notorious liar who hated the council and was on a crusade of revenge.
Wow, Hoppy said, showing a mouthful of potatoes.
Mr. Cristano thought you should sneak this to your wife, Nitschman said. She should show it only to those she can trust on the jury.
Right about that,
Hoppy said, quickly folding and stuffing it into a pocket. He looked around the crowded dining room as if he was completely guilty of something. Working from law school yearbooks and the limited records the registrar would release, it was learned that Jeff Kerr enrolled as a first-year law student at Kansas in the fall of 1989. His unsmiling face appeared with the second-year class in 1991, but there was no trace of him after that. He did not receive a law degree. He played rugby for the law school team his second year. A team photo showed him arm-in-arm with two pals, Michael Dale and Tom Ratliff, both of whom had finished law school the following year. Dale was working for legal services in Des Moines. Ratliff was an associate for a firm in Wichita. Investigators were sent to both places. Dante arrived in Lawrence and was taken to the law school, where he confirmed the identity of Kerr in the yearbooks. He spent an hour looking at faces from 1985 through 1994 and saw no female resembling the girl known as Marley. It was a shot in the dark. Many law students skipped the picture-taking. Yearbooks were sophomoric. These were serious young adults. Dante's work was nothing but a series of shots in the dark. Late Monday, the investigator named Small found Tom Ratliff hard at work in his tiny windowless office at Wise & Watkins, a large firm in downtown Wichita. They agreed to meet in a bar in an hour. Small talked to Fitch and gathered as much background as he could, or as much as Fitch would give him. Small was an ex-cop with two ex-wives. His title was security specialist, which in Lawrence meant he did everything from motel watching to polygraph exams. He was not bright, and Fitch realized this immediately. Ratliff arrived late, and they ordered drinks. Small did his best to bluff and act knowledgeable. Ratliff was suspicious. He said little at first, which was what could be expected from a person unexpectedly asked by a stranger to talk about an old acquaintance.
"I haven't seen him in 4 years," Ratliff said. "Have you talked to him?"
"No, not a word. He dropped out of school after our second year."
"Were you close to him?"
"I knew him well our first year, but we were not the best of friends. He withdrew after that. Is he in trouble?"
"No, not at all."
"Perhaps you should tell me why you're so interested."
Small recited in general terms what Fitch had told him to say, got most of it right, and it was close to the truth.
Jeff Kerr was a prospective juror in a large trial somewhere, and he, Small, had been hired by one of the parties to dig through his background.
"Where's the trial?" Ratliff asked.
"I can't say, but I assure you none of this is illegal. You're a lawyer, you understand."
Indeed he did. Ratliff had spent most of his brief career slaving under a litigation partner. Jury research was a chore he'd already learned to hate.
"How can I verify this?" he asked, like a real lawyer.
"I don't have the authority to divulge specifics about the trial. Let's do it like this. If I ask something which you think might be harmful to Kerr, then don't answer. Fair enough?"
"We'll give it a shot, okay? But if I get nervous, then I'm out of here."
"Fair enough.
Why did he quit law school?"
Ratliff took a sip of his beer and tried to remember.
"He was a good student, very bright. But after the first year, he suddenly hated the idea of being a lawyer. He clerked in a firm that summer, a big firm in Kansas City, and it soured him. Plus, he fell in love."
Fitch desperately wanted to know if there was a girl.
"Who was the woman?" Small asked.
"Claire."
"Claire who?"
Another sip.
"I can't remember right now."
"You knew her?"
"I knew who she was. Claire worked at a bar in downtown Lawrence, a college hangout favored by law students. I think that's where she met Jeff."
"Could you describe her?"
"Why? I thought this was about Jeff."
"I was asked to get a description of his girlfriend in law school. That's all I know." Small shrugged as if he couldn't help it.
They studied each other for a bit.
What the hell, thought Ratliff. He'd never see these people again. Jeff and Claire were distant memories anyway.
"Average height, about 5'6". Slender, dark hair, brown eyes, pretty girl. All the bells and whistles."
"Was she a student?"
"I'm not sure. I think maybe she had been. Maybe a grad student."
"At KU?"
"I don't know."
"What was the name of the hangout?"
"Mulligan's, downtown."
Small knew it well. At times he went there himself to drown his worries and admire the college girls.
"I've knocked back a few at Mulligan's," he said.
"Yeah, I miss it," Ratliff said wistfully.
"What did he do after he dropped out?"
"I'm not sure. I heard that he and Claire left town, but I never heard from him again."
Small thanked him and asked if he could call him at the office if he had more questions. Ratliff said he was awfully busy, but give it a try.
Small's boss in Lawrence had a friend who knew the guy who'd owned Mulligan's for 15 years. The advantages of a small town. Employment records weren't exactly confidential, especially for the owner of a bar who reported fewer than half of his cash sales. Her name was Claire Clement. Fitch rubbed his stubby hands together with glee as he took the news. He loved the chase. Marley was now Claire, a woman with a past who'd worked hard to cover it up. "Know thine enemy," he said aloud to his walls. "The first rule of warfare."
Chapter 24. The numbers returned with a vengeance Monday afternoon. The messenger was an economist, a man trained to look at the life of Jacob Wood and put a concise dollar figure on it. His name was Dr. Art Callison, a retired professor from a private school in Oregon no one had heard of. The math was not complicated, and Dr. Callison had obviously seen a courtroom before. He knew how to testify, how to keep the figures simple. He placed them on a chalkboard with a neat hand. When he died at 51, Jacob Wood's base salary was $40,000 a year, plus a retirement plan funded by his employer, plus other benefits. Assuming he would live and work until the age of 65, Callison placed his lost future earnings at $720,000. The law also allowed the factoring of inflation into this projection, and this upped the total to $1,180,000. Then the law required that this total be reduced to its present value, a concept that muddied the water a bit. Here Callison delivered a quick, friendly lecture to the jury on present value. The money might be worth $1,180,000 if paid out over 15 years, but for purposes of the lawsuit, he had to determine what it was worth at the moment. Thus, it had to be discounted. His new figure was $835,000. He did a superb job of assuring the jury that this figure dealt only with lost salary. He was an economist, quite untrained to place a value on the non-economic value of one's life. His job had nothing to do with the pain and suffering Mr. Wood endured as he died, had nothing to do with the loss his family had endured. A young defense lawyer named Felix Mason uttered his first words of the trial. He was one of Cable's partners, a specialist in economic forecasts, and unfortunately for him, his only appearance would be brief. He began his cross-examination of Dr. Callison by asking him how many times a year he testified. "That's all I do these days. I've retired from teaching," Callison answered. He took the question in every trial. "Are you being paid to testify?" Mason asked. The question was as tired as the answer. "Yes, I'm paid to be here, same as you." "How much?" $5,000 for consultation and testimony. No doubt among the lawyers that Callison was by far the cheapest expert of the trial. Mason had a problem with the rate of inflation Callison used in his calculations, and they haggled over the historical rise of the Consumer Price Index for 30 minutes. If Mason scored a point, no one noticed. He wanted Callison to agree that a more reasonable figure for Mr. Wood's lost wages would be $680,000. It really didn't matter. Rohr and his blue ribbon pack of trial lawyers would take either number. Lost wages were merely the starting point. Rohr would add to it pain and suffering, loss of enjoyment of life, loss of companionship, and a few incidentals, such as the cost of Mr. Wood's medical care and the price of his funeral. Then Rohr would go for the gold. He would show the jury how much cash Pynex owned and would ask them for a large chunk of it as punitive damages. With an hour to go, Rohr proudly announced to the court that the plaintiff will call its last witness, Mrs. Celeste Wood. The jury had been given no warning that the plaintiff was almost finished. A burden was suddenly lifted. The sluggish air of the late afternoon was immediately lighter. Several jurors couldn't conceal smiles. Several more lost their frowns. Their chairs rocked as they came to life. Tonight would be their seventh in sequestration. According to Nicholas's latest theory, the defense would take no more than 3 days. They did the math. They could be home by the weekend. In the 3 weeks she'd been sitting silently at the table with hordes of lawyers around her, Celeste Wood had barely uttered a whisper. She'd shown an amazing ability to ignore the lawyers, ignore the faces of the jurors, and stare straight ahead with a blank face at the witnesses. She'd worn every shade of black and gray dress, always with black hose and black shoes. Jerry had dubbed her Widow Wood during the first week. She was now 55, the same age her husband would have been but for the lung cancer. She was very thin, diminutive, with short gray hair. She worked for a regional library and had raised 3 children. Family portraits were passed to the jury. Celeste had given her deposition a year earlier, and she had been rehearsed by the professional handlers Rohr had brought in. She was under control, nervous but not fidgety, and determined to show no emotion. After all, her husband had been dead for 4 years. She and Rohr walked through their script without a flaw. She talked of her life with Jacob, how happy they'd been, the early years, the kids, then the grandchildren, their dreams of retirement. A few bumps in the road, but nothing serious, nothing until he got sick. He had wanted to quit smoking so badly, had tried many times with little success. The addiction was just too powerful. Celeste was sympathetic without working too hard for it. Her voice never wavered. Rohr had guessed, correctly, that false tears might not be well received by the jury. She didn't cry easily anyway. Cable passed on any cross-examination. What could he ask her? He rose and, with a sad countenance and humble air, said simply, "Your Honor, we have no questions for this witness." Fitch had a bunch of questions for the witness, but he couldn't get them asked in open court. After a proper grieving period, in fact it was over a year after the funeral, Celeste had started seeing a divorced man who was 7 years younger. According to good sources, they were planning a quiet wedding as soon as the trial was over. Fitch knew that Rohr himself had ordered her not to get married until after the trial. The jury wouldn't hear this in the courtroom, but Fitch was working on a plan to sneak it through the back door.
"The plaintiff rests," Rohr announced after he'd seated Celeste at the table.
The lawyers on both sides clutched one another and huddled into small groups of serious whispering. Judge Harkin studied some of the clutter on his bench. Then he looked at his weary jury.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I have good news and bad. The good news is obvious. The plaintiff has rested, and we're more than halfway finished. The defense is expected to call fewer witnesses than the plaintiff. The bad news is that we're required at this point in the trial to argue a bunch of motions. We'll do that tomorrow, probably all day. I'm sorry, but we have no choice."
Nicholas raised his hand. Harkin looked at him for a few seconds, then managed to say,
"Yes, Mr. Easter?"
"You mean we have to sit around the motel all day tomorrow?"
"I'm afraid so."
"I don't understand why." The lawyers unclutched and stopped their tiny conferences and gawked at Easter. It was rare for a juror to speak in open court.
"Because we have a list of things to do outside the presence of the jury."
"Oh, I understand that, but why do we have to sit around?"
"What do you want to do?"
"I can think of a lot of things. We could charter a big boat, go for a ride in the Gulf, fish if we want to."
"I can't ask the taxpayers of this county to pay for that, Mr. Easter."
"I thought we were taxpayers."
"The answer is no, I'm sorry."
"Forget the taxpayers. I'm sure these lawyers here wouldn't mind passing the plate. Look, ask each side to put up $1,000. We can charter a huge boat and have a wonderful time." Though Cable and Rohr both reacted at the same instant, Rohr managed to speak first as he jumped to his feet.
"We'd be more than happy to pay half, Your Honor."
"It's a great idea, Judge," Cable added quickly and loudly.
Harkin raised both hands, palms out.
"Hold it," he said.
Then he rubbed his temples and searched his brain for a precedent. Of course, there was none. No rule or law prohibiting it. No conflicts of interest. Lorene Duke tapped Nicholas on the arm and whispered something in his ear. His Honor said,
"Well, I've certainly never heard of this. It seems to fall into the discretionary category. Mr. Rohr?"
"It's harmless, Your Honor. Each side pays half. No problem."
"Mr. Cable?"
"I can think of no statute or rule of procedure which would prevent it. I agree with Mr. Rohr. If both sides split the cost, what's the harm?"
Nicholas raised his hand again. "Excuse me, Your Honor. It's come to my attention that perhaps some of the jurors would rather shop in New Orleans than take a boat ride in the Gulf." Again, Rohr was a beat quicker.
"We'll be happy to split the cost of a bus, Your Honor, and lunch."
"Same here," Cable said. "Dinner, too."
Gloria Lane hustled to the jury box with a clipboard. Nicholas, Jerry Fernandez, Lonnie Shaver, Ricky Coleman, Angel Weiss, and Colonel Herrera opted for the boat. The rest chose the French Quarter. Including the video of Jacob Wood, Rohr and Company presented 10 witnesses to the jury and took 13 days to do it. A solid case was built. Now it was up to the jury to determine not if cigarettes were dangerous, but if it was time to punish their makers. Had the jury not been sequestered, Rohr would have called at least 3 more experts. One to discuss the psychology of advertising, one an expert on addiction, one ready to describe in detail the application of insecticides and pesticides to tobacco leaves. But the jury was very sequestered, and Rohr knew it was time to stop. It was obvious this was no ordinary jury. A blind man, a misfit who did yoga at lunch, at least 2 strikes so far, lists of demands at every turn, china and silver for lunch, beer after work paid for by the taxpayers, communal interludes and personal visits. Judge Harkin was finding sleep difficult. It was certainly not ordinary for Fitch, a man who'd sabotaged more juries than any person in the history of American jurisprudence. He'd laid the usual traps and gathered the usual dirt. His scams were proceeding flawlessly. Only 1 fire so far. No broken bones. But the girl Marley
had changed everything. Through her, he'd be able to purchase a verdict, a slam-dunk defense judgment that would humiliate Rohr and frighten away the legion of hungry trial lawyers circling like vultures waiting for the carcass. In this, the biggest tobacco trial yet, with the biggest plaintiff's lawyers lined up with millions, his beloved little Marley would hand him a verdict. Fitch believed this, and it consumed him. He thought of her every minute, and he saw her in his dreams. If not for Marley, Fitch wouldn't be sleeping at all. The time was right for a plaintiff's verdict. Right courtroom, right judge, right mood. The experts were by far the best Fitch had encountered in his 9 years of directing the defense. 9 years, 8 trials, 8 defense verdicts. As much as he hated Rohr, he could admit only to himself that he was the right lawyer to nail the industry. A victory over Rohr in Biloxi would be a huge barricade to future tobacco litigation. It might very well save the industry. When Fitch tallied the jury's vote, he always started with Ricky Coleman because of the abortion. He had her vote in his pocket. She just didn't know it yet. Then he added Lonnie Shaver, then Colonel Herrera. Millie Dupree would be easy. His jury people were convinced that Sylvia Taylor Tatum was virtually incapable of sympathy, and besides, she smoked. But his jury people didn't know she was sleeping with Jerry Fernandez. Jerry and Easter were buddies. Fitch was predicting the three of them, Sylvia, Jerry, and Nicholas, would vote the same. Lorene Duke sat next to Nicholas, and the two were often seen whispering during the trial. Fitch thought she would follow Easter. And if Lorene did, then so would Angel Wheeze, the only other black female. Wheeze was impossible to read. No one doubted that Easter would dominate the deliberations. Now that Fitch knew Easter had 2 years of law school, he was willing to bet that this information had been shared with the entire jury. It was impossible to predict how Herman Grimes might vote, but Fitch wasn't counting on him. Likewise with Philip Savelle. Fitch felt good about Mrs. Gladys Card. She was old and conservative, and likely to be turned off when Rohr asked them for $20 million or so. So Fitch had 4 in the bag, with Mrs. Gladys Card being a possible 5th. Flip a coin on Herman Grimes, concede Savelle on the grounds that anyone so in tune with nature had to dislike tobacco companies. That left Easter and his gang of 5. 9 votes were needed by either side for a verdict. Anything less would hang the jury and force Harkin to declare a mistrial. Mistrials become retrials, something Fitch did not want in this case. The horde of legal analysts and scholars closely watching the trial agreed on little, but they were unified in their prediction that a unanimous 12-vote verdict in favor of Pinex would chill, if not completely freeze, tobacco litigation for a decade. Fitch was determined to deliver one, whatever the cost. The mood in Rohr's office was much lighter Monday night. With no more witnesses to call, the pressure was momentarily off. Some fine scotch was poured in the conference room. Rohr sipped his mineral water and nibbled on cheese and crackers. The ball was now in Cable's court. Let him and his crew spend a few days prepping witnesses and labeling documents. Rohr had only to react, to cross-examine. And he had watched every videotaped deposition of every defense witness 12 times. Jonathan Kotlak, the lawyer in charge of jury research, likewise drank only water and speculated with Rohr about Herman Grimes. Both felt they had him. And they felt good about Millie Dupree and Savelle, the strange one. Herrera worried them. All 3 of the blacks, Lonnie, Angel, and Lorene, were solidly on board. It was, after all, a case of a little person against a large, powerful corporation. Surely the blacks would come through. They always did. Easter was the key because he was the leader. Everybody knew that. Ricky would follow him. Jerry was his pal. Sylvia Taylor Tatum was passive, and she'd follow the crowd, as would Mrs. Gladys Card. They only needed 9, and Rohr was convinced he had them. Chapter 25. Back in Lawrence, Small, the investigator, worked his list of leads diligently and got nowhere. He loafed around Mulligan's Monday night, drinking against orders, chatting occasionally with the waitresses and law students, and succeeding at nothing but arousing suspicion among the youth. Early Tuesday morning, he made one visit too many. The woman's name was Rebecca, and a few years back, while still a grad student at KU, she'd worked at Mulligan's with Claire Clement. They had been friends, according to a source dug up by Small's boss. Small found her in a downtown bank where she worked as manager. He introduced himself awkwardly, and she was immediately suspicious. "Did you work with Claire Clement a few years back?" he asked, looking at a notepad standing on one side of her desk because she was standing on the other. He had not been invited in, and she was busy. "Maybe. Who wants to know?" Rebecca asked, arms crossed, head cocked, phone buzzing somewhere behind her. In marked contrast to Small, she was sharply dressed and missed nothing.
"Do you know where she is now?"
"No. Why are you asking?" Small repeated the narrative he'd memorized. It was all he had.
"Well, see, she's a potential juror in a big trial, and my firm has been hired to conduct a thorough investigation into her background."
"Where's the trial?"
"Can't tell you that. You guys worked together at Mulligan's, right?"
"Yes. That was a long time ago."
"Where was she from?"
"Why is that important?"
"Well, to be honest, it's on my list of questions. We're just checking her out, okay? Do you know where she came from?"
"No."
This was an important question because Claire's trail had started and stopped in Lawrence.
"Are you sure?"
She cocked her head the other way and glared at this klutz.
"I don't know where she came from. When I met her, she was working at Mulligan's. The last time I saw her, she was working at Mulligan's."
"Have you talked to her recently?"
"Not in the last 4 years."
"Did you know Jeff Kerr?"
"No."
"Who were her friends here in Lawrence?"
"I don't know. Look, I'm very busy and you're wasting your time. I didn't know Claire that well. Nice girl and all, but we were not close. Now please, I have things to do."
She was pointing to the door by the time she finished, and Small reluctantly left her office. With Small out of the bank, Rebecca closed her office door and dialed the number to an apartment in St. Louis. The recorded voice on the other end belonged to her friend, Claire. They chatted at least once a month, though they hadn't seen each other in a year. Claire and Jeff lived an odd life, drifting and never staying long in one place, never anxious to reveal their whereabouts. Only the apartment in St. Louis remained the same. Claire had warned her that people might come poking around with curious questions. She had hinted more than once that she and Jeff were working for the government in some mysterious capacity. At the sound of the tone, Rebecca left a brief message about Small's visit. Marley checked her voicemail each morning, and the message from Lawrence made her blood run cold. She wiped her face with a moist cloth and tried to calm herself. She called Rebecca and managed to sound perfectly normal, though her mouth was dry and her heart was pounding. Yes, the man named Small had specifically asked about Claire Clement, and he had mentioned Jeff Kerr. With Marley's prompting, Rebecca managed to replay the entire conversation. Rebecca knew not to ask too many questions. "Are you okay?" was about the extent of her inquiry. "Oh, we're fine," Marley assured her. "Living on the beach for a while." Which beach would be nice, but Rebecca let it pass. No one dug too deep with Claire. They said their goodbyes with the usual promises to keep in touch. Neither she nor Nicholas had believed they would ever be tracked to Lawrence. Now that they had, the questions fell like hard rain around her. Who had found them? Which side, Fitch or Rohr? Most likely Fitch, simply because he had more money and more cunning. What had been their mistake? How did the trail ever leave Biloxi? How much did they know? And how far would they go? She needed to speak to Nicholas, but he was at the moment on a boat somewhere in the Gulf, trolling for mackerel and bonding with his fellow jurors. Fitch, of course, was not fishing. In fact, he hadn't taken a day of rest or pleasure in 3 months. He was at his desk, neatly arranging piles of paperwork when the call came. "Hello, Marley," he said into the receiver to the girl of his dreams.
"Hey, Fitch. You've lost another one."
"Another what?" he asked, biting his tongue to keep from calling her Claire.
"Another juror. Lorene Duke was enthralled by Mr. Robilio, and now she's leading the parade to reward the plaintiff.
But she hasn't heard our case yet.
True. You have 4 smokers now, Weeze, Fernandez, Taylor Tatum, and Easter. Guess how many started smoking after the age of 18?
Don't know.
None. They all started as kids. Herman and Herrera used to smoke. Guess how old they were when they started?
Don't know.
14 and 17. That's half of your jury, Fitch, and all started smoking as minors.
What am I supposed to do about it?
Keep lying, I guess. Look, Fitch, what are the chances of us getting together for a little chat? Private, you know, without all your goons ducking behind bushes?
The chances are excellent.
Another lie. Let's do it this way. Let's meet and talk, and if my people see your people anywhere near us, then it will be our last conversation.
Your people?
Anybody can hire goons, Fitch. You should know this.
It's a deal.
You know Casella's, the little seafood joint with outdoor tables at the end of the Biloxi Pier?
I can find it.
That's where I am now. So when you walk down the pier, I'll be watching. And if I see any character who looks the least bit suspicious, deal's off.
When?
Right now. I'm waiting.
Jose slowed for a second in the parking lot near the small craft harbor, and Fitch practically jumped from the Suburban. It drove away, and Fitch, very much alone and unwired, strolled down the wooden pier with the heavy wooden plank shifting gently in the tide. Marley sat at a wooden table with an umbrella above it, with her back to the gulf, her face to the pier. Lunch was an hour away, and the place was deserted.
"Hello, Marley," Fitch said as he approached, stopped, then sat across from her.
She wore jeans and a denim shirt, a fishing cap, and sunglasses. "A pleasure, Fitch," she said.
"Are you always so surly?" he asked, settling his squatty frame into a narrow chair, trying his best to smile and be chummy.
"Are you wired, Fitch?"
"No, of course not."
Slowly, she removed from her bulky purse a thin black device resembling a small dictaphone. She pushed a button and placed it on the table, aimed at Fitch's ample gut.
"Pardon me, Fitch, just checking to see if you had time to stick a bug here or there."
"I said I wasn't wired, okay?" Fitch said, very relieved.
Conrad had suggested a small body mic with a tech van parked nearby, but Fitch, in a hurry, had said no. She glanced at the tiny digital monitor on the end of the sensor scan, then placed it back in her purse. Fitch smiled, but only for a second.
"I got a call from Lawrence this morning," she said, and Fitch swallowed hard. "Evidently you've got some real meatheads up there banging on doors and kicking over trash cans."
"I don't know what you're talking about," Fitch said, somewhat unsteadily and without sufficient conviction.
It was Fitch. His eyes betrayed him. They fluttered and dropped and darted away quickly before returning to see her, then dropped again, all in an instant, but with plenty of proof that she'd caught him.
His breath was short for a second, and his shoulders jerked ever so slightly. He'd been nailed.
"Right. One more phone call from old friends, and you'll never hear my voice again."
He rallied adequately, though.
"What's in Lawrence?" he demanded, as if his integrity had been questioned.
"Give it up, Fitch, and call off the dogs."
He exhaled heavily while shrugging in utter bewilderment.
"Fine, whatever. I just wish I knew what you were talking about."
"You do. One more phone call and it's over. Okay?"
"Okay, whatever you say."
Though Fitch couldn't see her eyes, he could feel them beaming at him from behind the thick glasses. She said nothing for a minute. A waiter busied himself at a nearby table but made no effort to serve them. Finally, Fitch leaned forward and said,
"When do we stop playing games?"
"Now."
"Wonderful. What do you want?"
"Money."
"I figured. How much?"
"I'll name a price later. I take it you're ready to deal."
"I'm always ready to deal, but I gotta know what I get in return."
"It's very simple, Fitch. It depends on what you want. As far as you're concerned, this jury can do one of 4 things. It can deliver a verdict for the plaintiff. It can split and hang and go home, and you'll be back down here in a year or so doing this again. Roar isn't going away. It can come back 9-3 for you, and you get a huge victory. and it can come back 12-0, and your clients can relax for several years.
I know all this.
Of course you do. If we rule out a plaintiff's verdict, then we have three choices.
What can you deliver?
Anything I want, including a plaintiff's verdict.
So the other side is willing to pay.
We're talking. Let's just leave it at that.
Is this an auction? Your verdict to the highest bidder?
It's whatever I want it to be.
I'd feel better if you'd stay away from Roar.
I'm not too concerned with your feelings. Another waiter appeared and noticed them. He reluctantly asked if they'd like something to drink. Fitch wanted iced tea. Marley asked for a Diet Coke in a can.
Tell me how the deal works, he said when the waiter left.
It's very simple. We agree on the verdict you want. Just look at the menu and place your order. Then we agree on the price. You get your money ready. We wait until the very end, until the lawyers finish their closing arguments and the jury retires to deliberate. At that point, I furnish you with wiring instructions, and the money is immediately sent to a bank in, say, Switzerland. Once I get confirmation the money has been received, then the jury returns with your verdict.
Fitch had spent hours predicting a scenario remarkably similar to this, but to hear it come from Marley's lips with such a cool precision made his heart pound and his head spin. This could be the easiest one yet.
Won't work, he said smugly, like a man who'd negotiated many such verdict deals.
Oh, really? Roar thinks it will.
Damn, she was quick. She knew just exactly where to stick the knife. But there's no guarantee, he protested.
She adjusted her sunglasses and leaned forward on her elbows. So you doubt me, Fitch?
That's not the issue. You're asking me to wire what I'm sure will be a large sum of money on the hope and prayer that your friend will control the deliberations. Juries are so unpredictable.
Fitch, my friend is controlling the deliberations even as we speak. He'll have his votes long before the lawyers stop talking.
Fitch would pay. He'd made the decision a week earlier to pay whatever she wanted, and he knew that when the money left the fund there were no guarantees. He didn't care. He trusted his Marley. She and her friend Easter, or whatever the hell his name was, had patiently stalked Big Tobacco to reach this point, and they would happily hand over a verdict for the right price. They had lived for this moment. Oh, the questions he wanted to ask. He'd love to start with the two of them and ask whose idea this was. Such an ingenious, devious plan to study litigation, then follow it across the country, then plant oneself on the jury so a deal could be cut for a verdict. It was nothing short of brilliant. He could grill her for hours, maybe days, about the specifics. But he knew there would be no answers. He also knew she'd deliver. She had worked too hard and had come too far with their plot to fail.
I'm not totally helpless in this matter, you know, he said, still holding his ground.
Of course not, Fitch. I'm sure you've laid enough traps to snag at least four jurors. Shall I name them?
The drinks arrived and Fitch gulped his tea. No, he did not want her to name them. He would not play a guessing game with someone who had the hard facts. Talking with Marley was like talking to the leader of the jury, and though Fitch cherished the moment, it made the conversation quite one-sided. How was he to know if she was bluffing or telling the truth? It simply wasn't fair.
I sense you doubt whether I'm in control, she said.
I doubt everything.
What if I get a juror bumped?
You've already bumped Stella Hulick, Fitch said, and drew the first and only very small smile from her.
I can do it again. What if, say, I decided to send home Lonnie Shaver? Would you be impressed?
Fitch almost choked on his tea. He wiped his mouth with the back of a hand, said, I'm sure Lonnie would be happy. He's probably the most bored of the 12.
Shall I bump him?
No, he's harmless. Plus, since we'll be working together, I think we should keep Lonnie.
He and Nicholas talk a lot, you know.
Is Nicholas talking to everyone?
Yes, at various levels. Give him time.
You seem confident.
I'm not confident in the ability of your lawyers, but I am confident in Nicholas, and that's all that matters.
They sat quietly and waited for two waiters to set the table next to them. Lunch began at 11:30 and the cafe was coming to life. When the waiters finished and left, Fitch said, "I can't cut a deal if I don't know the terms." Without the slightest hesitation, she said, "And I'm not cutting a deal as long as you're digging through my past."
"Got something to hide?"
"No, but I have friends and I don't like getting phone calls from them. Stop it now and this meeting will lead to the next. One more phone call, and I'll never speak to you again."
"Don't say that."
"I mean it, Fitch. Call off the dogs."
"They're not my dogs, I swear."
"Call them off anyway, or I'll spend more time with Roar. He might want to cut a deal, and a verdict for him means you're out of work and your clients lose billions. You can't afford it, Fitch." She was certainly right about that. Whatever she planned to ask for would be a tiny sum compared to the ultimate cost of a plaintiff's verdict.
"We'd better move fast," he said. "This trial won't last much longer."
"How long?" she asked.
3 or 4 days for the defense."
"Fitch, I'm hungry. Why don't you leave and retrace your steps? I'll call you in a couple of days."
"What a coincidence. I'm hungry, too."
"No, thanks. I'll eat alone. Plus, I want you away from here."
He rose, said, "Sure, Marley, whatever you want. Good day."
She watched him saunter back down the pier to the parking lot next to the beach. He stopped there and called someone from a cell phone. After repeated attempts to reach Hoppy by phone, Jimmy Hull Moak dropped in unannounced on Dupree Realty Tuesday afternoon and was told by a sleepy-eyed receptionist that Mr. Dupree was somewhere in the back. She left to fetch him and returned 15 minutes later with the apology that she had been wrong, that Mr. Dupree was not in his office and had, in fact, left for an important meeting.
"I see his car out there," Jimmy Hull said, agitated, pointing to the small parking lot just outside the door. Sure enough, there was Hoppy's old station wagon.
"He rode with someone else," she said, obviously lying.
"Where'd he go?" Jimmy Hull asked, as if he might go after him.
"Somewhere near Pass Christian. That's all I know."
"Why won't he return my phone calls?"
"I have no idea. Mr. Dupree is a very busy man."
Jimmy Hull shoved both hands deep in the pockets of his jeans and glared down at the woman.
"You tell him I stopped by, that I'm very irritated, and that he'd better call me. You got that?"
"Yes, sir."
He left the office, got in his Ford pickup, and drove away. She watched, to be safe, then raced to the back to free Hoppy from the broom closet. The 60-footer with Captain Theo at the helm traveled 50 miles into the Gulf, where under a cloudless sky and amid gentle sea breezes, half the jury fished for mackerel, snapper, and redfish. Angel Wheeze had never been on a boat, couldn't swim, and got sick 200 yards from shore, but with the help of a seasoned deckhand and a bottle of Dramamine, she recovered and actually caught the first fish of any size. Ricky looked splendidly cute with shorts, Reeboks, tanned legs. The colonel and the captain were inevitably kindred spirits, and it wasn't long before Knapp was on the bridge talking naval strategy and exchanging war stories. Two deckhands prepared a fine lunch of boiled shrimp, fried oyster sandwiches, crab claws, and chowder. The first round of beer was served with lunch. Only Ricky abstained and drank water. The beer continued throughout the afternoon as the fishing alternated between frenzy and boredom, and as the sun grew warmer on the deck. The boat was large enough to find privacy. Nicholas and Jerry made certain that Lonnie Shaver kept a cold beer in hand. They were determined to chat him up for the first time. Lonnie had an uncle who'd worked on a shrimp boat for many years before it sank in a storm and the entire crew was never found. When he was a kid, he'd fished these waters with his uncle, and frankly, he'd had his share of fishing. Despised it, really, and hadn't been in years. Still, the boat trip sounded a bit more tolerable than the bus ride to New Orleans. It took 4 beers to knock the edge off and loosen the tongue. They lounged in a small upper deck cabin, open on all sides. On the main deck below them, Ricky and Angel were watching the deckhands clean their catch. "I wonder how many experts the defense will call," Nicholas said, changing the subject from fishing with near-total exasperation.
Jerry was lying on a plastic cot, his socks and shoes off, his eyes closed, cold beer in hand.
"They don't have to call any, as far as I'm concerned," Lonnie said, gazing at the sea.
"You've had enough, huh?" Nicholas said.
"Pretty damned ridiculous. Man smokes for 35 years and wants millions for his estate after he kills himself."
"See what I told you," Jerry said without opening his eyes.
"What?" Lonnie asked.
"Jerry and I had you pegged as a defense juror," Nicholas explained. "It was difficult, though, because you've had so little to say."
"And what are you?" Lonnie asked.
"Me? I'm still open-minded."
"Jerry's leaning toward the defense, right, Jerry?"
"I have not discussed the case with anyone. I have had no unauthorized contact. I have not taken any bribes. I am a juror Judge Harkin can be proud of."
"He's leaning toward the defense," Nicholas said to Lonnie.
"Because he's addicted to nicotine. Can't kick the habit, but he's convinced himself he can throw him away whenever he wants. He can't because he's a wimp, but he wants to be a real man, like Colonel Herrera."
"Who doesn't?" Lonnie said.
"Jerry thinks that because he can quit if he really wanted to, then anyone should be able to quit, which he can't do himself, and therefore Jacob Wood should have stopped long before he got cancer."
"That's about right," Jerry said. "But I object to the part about the wimp."
"Makes good sense to me," Lonnie said.
"How can you be open-minded?"
"Gee, I don't know. Maybe it's because I haven't heard all the testimony yet."
"Yeah, that's it. The law says that we must refrain from reaching verdicts until all the evidence is in. Forgive me."
"You're forgiven," Jerry said. "Now it's your turn to fetch another round."
Nicholas drained his can and walked down the narrow stairway to the cooler on the main deck.
"Don't worry about him," Jerry said. "He'll be with us when it counts."
Chapter 26. The boat returned a few minutes after 5. The hearty band of fishermen staggered from the deck onto the pier, where they posed for photos with Captain Theo and their trophies, the largest of which was a 90-pound shark hooked by Ricky and landed by a deckhand. They were gathered by 2 deputies and led down the pier, leaving behind their catch because there was certainly no use for it at the motel. The bus with the shoppers would be another hour. Its arrival, as was the arrival of the boat, was duly watched, recorded, and relayed to Fitch. But for whatever purpose, no one was sure. Fitch just wanted to know. They had to watch something. It was a slow day, not much to do but sit and wait for the jury to return. Fitch was locked in his office with Swanson, who'd spent most of the afternoon on the phone. The meatheads, as Marley had described them, had been called off. In their place, Fitch was sending in the professionals, the same Bethesda firm he was using for the hoppy sting. Swanson had once worked there, and many of the agents were either ex-FBI or ex-CIA. Results were guaranteed. It was hardly a job to get them excited, the uncovering of a young woman's past. Swanson was to leave in an hour and fly to Kansas City, where he would monitor things. There was also a guarantee not to get caught. Fitch was in a quandary. He had to hold Marley, yet he also had to know who she was. 2 factors pushed him to keep digging. First, it was terribly important to her that he stop. There was something hidden back there that was crucial. And second, she had gone to such lengths to leave no trail. Marley had left Lawrence, Kansas 4 years ago after living there for 3 years. She was not Claire Clement until she arrived, and she certainly was not when she left. In the meantime, she met and recruited Jeff Kerr, who was now Nicholas Easter and was now doing hell knows what to the jury. Angel Weese was in love with and planned to marry Derek Maples, a strapping young man of 24 who was between jobs and between wives. He'd lost his job selling car phones when the company merged, and he was now in the process of dispensing with his first wife, the result of a teenage romance gone bad. They had 2 young children. His wife and her lawyer wanted $600 a month in child support. Derek and his lawyer waved his unemployment like a burning flag. The negotiations had turned bitter, and a final divorce was months away. Angel was 2 months pregnant, though she'd told no one but Derek. Derek's brother, Marvis, had once been a deputy sheriff and was now a part-time minister and community activist. Marvis was approached by a man named Cleve, who said he'd like to meet Derek. Introductions were made. For lack of a better job description, Cleve was known as a runner. He ran cases for Wendell Rohr. Cleve's task was to find good, solid death and injury claims and make sure they found their way to Rohr's office. Good running was an art form, and of course Cleve was a fine runner, because Rohr would have nothing but the best. Like all good runners, Cleve moved in shadowy circles, because the soliciting of clients was still technically an unethical practice, though any decent car wreck would attract more runners than emergency personnel. In fact, Cleve's business card pronounced him to be an investigator. Cleve also delivered papers for Rohr, served summonses, checked on witnesses,